The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you all for being here. It matters a lot to me that you're coming out to hear these stories, so thank you. So America is weird for how much poverty we have. There's no other rich democracy in the world that has the kind of poverty we have, the amount of poverty we have, and the depth of the poverty that we have. And that's a fact that's always bothered me. I've always found that pretty unnecessary. And I wanted to understand the role that housing plays in that story. And I thought that eviction was a really good way into that problem. And so I started this work the old-fashioned way. I moved into a trailer park on the south side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I rented a trailer, and I lived there for about 5 months. And then I moved to the north side of the city, which is the inner city of Milwaukee. It's like North Philly. And I lived there for about 10 months. I rented a room in a rooming house. And from those two neighborhoods, I followed families getting evicted, and I followed them everywhere they went. I went to eviction court with them. I went to shelters and abandoned homes. I watched their kids. I slept on their floors. I ate from their dinner tables. I went to AA meetings with them and church with them and parole officers meetings with them and was there for funerals and was even there for a birth. But I knew that to really understand the kind of role that housing is playing in deepening poverty in our cities, I needed to get landlords' perspectives too. I wanted to understand what makes them tick. Why do they buy properties in some of our worst neighborhoods? Why do they evict you but not you? And so if you were getting evicted, I wanted to get just as deep with your landlord doing the evicting as I did with you. So I did. And so I went to eviction court with them too, and I saw landlords buy and sell properties, watched them pass out eviction notices and collect rents, understood what ticks them off and kind of what motivates them, and put those two stories together and really try to write a book not about a poor neighborhood or a subpopulation of low-income folks, but really about this really deep, old, really important relationship, the tenant-landlord relationship. But as I was going along, there were all these questions about eviction that kept popping up in my head that I just couldn't answer with that kind of field work. Like, how often does eviction happen? Who does it happen to? What are the long-term consequences of eviction? So I went looking for studies or data that would allow me to get my hands around this question and came up empty, which was surprising. I mean, this is a project about poverty in the United States in a city. I mean, this is like sociology 101. But what we had done is we had spent a lot of time writing on public housing, and we had spent a lot of time looking through housing so we can arrive at claims about the neighborhood. But the private rental market, where the vast majority of low-income families were living, we had overlooked. But I was seeing this thing every day consume most of the incomes of the families I was spending time with, dictating where they lived, who they lived with, destabilizing families or communities, and we didn't know a lot about it. So I went ahead and collected some other kind of data too. One thing I did was design a survey called the Milwaukee Area Renters Survey, and we ended up surveying over 1,000 renters in the city of Milwaukee. We sent interviewers into neighborhoods, including very affluent neighborhoods, those are the blue dots, and some very disadvantaged neighborhoods, those are the red dots or the orange dots. And we interviewed tenants in their place of residence. One interviewer was mugged, another one was bitten by a dog. It's actually the same interviewer who needs to work on his situational awareness. But we worked really hard for this new kind of data about the role that housing is playing in poverty in our cities, and we got an 84% response rate, which is really kind of a gold standard response rate for this kind of work. And what I was learning while I was in the field was deeply informing the kinds of questions we ask folks, not just what we ask them, but how we ask them. So take just how to ask about eviction. So when I was living in the trailer park, one of my neighbors, Tim, hurt his back on the job, lost it, got evicted after the income slowed to a trickle, was taken to court, moved out of his trailer, but he just doesn't think he was evicted. When I was talking to his wife, Rose, she told me, when you say eviction, I think of the sheriff's coming and throwing you out, changing your locks, Eagle Movers comes and tosses your stuff on the curb. That's an eviction. We weren't evicted. So if we were like every other game in town and we just asked, like, Rose and Tim, were you evicted? They would have said no. we learn to ask the question differently, and I think it speaks to this kind of work, this kind of ground level shoe leather work to kind of a bigger data. I didn't stop there. We analyzed over hundreds of thousands of eviction records in the city of Milwaukee. We talked to 250 people in eviction court. We analyzed millions of 911 records, and we put all those kind of data together in a conversation, and each kind of piece or each kind of approach kind of pushed and challenged the other, and they all kept each other honest. But Evicted, the book, begins on the ground and it ends on the ground. It really prioritized people's stories. And so we follow 8 families through the process of eviction. Some are white, some are black, some have kids, some don't. We meet Lorraine, who is my neighbor in the trailer park, who was a grandma, and she had to decide, should I pay my rent or should I pay the heat? She was spending 70% of her income to rent a trailer. We meet Lamar, who is this really gregarious single dad raising 2 boys in the inner city of Milwaukee. His house was like the house that all the boys went to after school. You know, it was like that house on the block. He was in a wheelchair, and he fell behind in rent and tried to work it off with his landlord, and it didn't work out for him. We meet Vanetta, who is a single mom of 3 young kids, who organized an Easter egg hunt in the homeless shelter to kind of bring her kids some light in this really tough time. This was a mother who worked at Old Country Buffet, had no criminal record, but when her hours got cut, she was so terrified as losing her home and losing her kids that she committed an armed robbery to try to keep her kids in the home. I can't tell you about all these amazing people that the book talks about, but I do want to share with you tonight one story, one person's story, and that's Arlene's story. So it had been a really difficult year ever since the snowball. Arlene's 14-year-old son, Jory, and his cousin were cutting up like 14-year-olds do. They were throwing snowballs at passing cars. And Jory packed a really good one and just smacked this car. And it jerked to a stop. And this man jumped out. And Jory and his cousin ran inside and locked the door. And the man kicked it in. And thank God he left before anything else happened. But when Arlene's landlord found out about that, she decided to evict Arlene and her 2 boys for damaging property. And Arlene cussed at Jory because she couldn't cuss the landlord. So Arlene took her 2 sons, Jory and Jafaris. Jafaris was 6, to the Salvation Army homeless shelter, which everyone in Milwaukee calls the Lodge. So you can tell your kids, like, we're staying at the Lodge tonight, like it's a hotel. And from there, they were on the hunt for another place to live. And they found one on 19th Street. There was often no water, and Jory had to bucket out what was in the toilet. It was quiet, Arlene remembered, and $5.25 for a whole house. It was my favorite place. When we looked at the survey data, one thing that we found was that families that get evicted move into much worse housing. If we want to know why some low-income families live with exposed wires and lead paint and broken windows, things that are really bad for kids' health, one reason is that they're forced to in the harried aftermath of an eviction. So the city eventually found Arlene's favorite place. This is it, unfit for human habitation. And then men with hard hats kind of boarded up the windows and the doors, and the family was once again on the hunt for another place to live. We take whatever we can get, Arlene told Jory. And that's what it looks like to like look for housing in a neighborhood at the very bottom, just like taking what you could get. And what Arlene could get was a drab apartment complex on Atkinson Avenue. But she soon learned it was a haven for drug dealers. In fact, the whole block was drug-soaked. It was a hot block. And Arlene was terrified for her boys, especially Jory, who was goofy and had a beautiful smile and would talk to anyone. So why Arlene moved, the fact that she was evicted, was really important in explaining why she ended up in such a bad neighborhood. And that's a relationship you can test with statistical data too. And we did. And we found that all else equal, families that are evicted move from poor neighborhoods to even poorer ones, from pretty dangerous neighborhoods to neighborhoods with even higher amounts of crime. So Arlene moved out as fast as she could, and she found a 2-bedroom bottom unit duplex on Keefe Avenue and 13th Street. And there was a fist-sized hole in the living room window, and the carpet was filthy and grounded to the floor, and the door had to be locked with this ugly wooden plank. But Arlene put on a good face. She hung ivory curtains, and she stuffed a piece of cloth into the hole in the window. The rent for that kind of place in a very poor neighborhood in America's 4th poorest city was $550. That took 88% of Arlene's welfare check. And she knew that some months she'd have to sell her food stamps to get by, and the refrigerator and the pantry would be empty. Her and the boys would try to get by on oodles and noodles. Under those conditions, there's no extra money for, like, anything. You know, you can't buy jewelry, clothes, or books. No money for toys for Jafaris. So Jafaris had this amazing ability to transform like a broken mop handle or like a dog leash into soldiers and tanks locked in battle. So Arlene is not alone in spending the majority of her income on housing. For about the last 100 years in America, we've come to a consensus that we should spend no more than 30% of our income on housing costs. That gives us enough money to afford food and transportation. For a long time, most renters in this country met that goal. But times have changed. The percentage of poor renting families spending 30% of their income or less on housing costs, that blue line, has slowly declined over the years. But the percentage of poor renting families spending at least half of their income has risen to the point that today, most poor renting families in America are spending at least half of their income on housing, and at least one in four of those families are spending over 70% just on rent and utilities. Just imagine that, like 70% at the beginning of the month is poof, gone. Under those conditions, you don't need a major shock or a huge emergency to invite eviction. Something as innocent as a snowball can do it. For people like Arlene, eviction is much more the result of inevitability than personal irresponsibility. So what's happened? Three things have happened. Over the last 20 years, but especially in the 2000s, housing costs all around the country have increased dramatically. They've increased in the East Coast, like in Philly, but also in the South, in the middle of the country, and the West Coast as well. Between 1995 and today, median rent in this country has increased by over 70% in current dollars. Utility costs have risen too. In the 2000s, utility costs, the cost for fuels and other kind of utilities, increased by over 50% thanks to the expiration of price caps and global competition. Those advances in housing costs have far outpaced the incomes for low-income Americans. These lines show median household income for households headed by folks with a high school education, that's a purple line, or families headed by folks with less than a high school education, that's the green line. And you've seen these stagnant incomes for the last 20 years, especially among low-income, low-education Americans. During the years where more and more Americans kind of saw their housing costs soar, their incomes were falling or flatlining. But during that time, federal assistance was not being rolled out to meet that kind of growing gap in need. I think most Americans still think that the typical low-income family lives in public housing or benefits in some way from the government for housing assistance. But the opposite is true. Among poor renters, about 15% live in public housing. That's the green dot. About 17% benefit in some other way, like they receive a housing voucher and they only pay 30% of their income on housing. But the vast majority, the remaining two-thirds, receive nothing, nada, absolutely no assistance. And if you look at all families that qualify for housing assistance in the country, you realize that only one in four who qualifies it receives it. That relationship would be unthinkable when it comes to other basic necessities. Like imagine if we turned away three in four families that apply for food stamps. We don't have enough. I'm sorry, you have to go hungry. But that's exactly how we treat low-income families searching for affordable housing today. Arlene gave up looking for housing assistance a long time ago, but one day on a whim, she stopped by the housing authority and asked about the list. And she was told by the person behind the glass, the list is frozen. She couldn't put her name on it because on it were 3,500 families that had applied for rent assistance 4 years ago. It could be way worse. Like in some of our largest cities, the waiting list for public housing is not counted in years. It's counted in decades. So a single parent that applies for public housing in Washington, D.C., for example, is probably a grandparent by the time their application comes up for renewal. So if Arlene wanted public housing, this is what she'd have to do. She'd have to wait 3 years until the list unfroze. Then she'd have to wait another 5 years until her application made it to the top of the pile. And then she'd just have to, like, pray that the person reviewing her application would ignore all the evictions she'd collected while trying to make ends meet unassisted in the private market on a welfare check. So on 13th Street, Arlene found this bucket of paint and rollers in the basement, and she gave the walls a fresh coat. But not long after moving in, her sister died. It wasn't her biological sister. It was like her sister in the spiritual sense, close friends. And she contributed some money to the funeral cost. She didn't have the money, but no one else did either, and she felt it was her obligation, her duty, to pitch in. The next month, she missed an appointment with her welfare caseworker because the letter announcing the appointment was mailed to 19th Street, or maybe Atkinson Avenue. Whatever it was, the caseworker typed something into the computer, and Arlene's $628 a month check was cut. They call it sanctioned. She was 2 months behind, so she got the pink papers, the eviction summons and complaint. So Milwaukee is a city of about 105,000 renter households. Every year in Milwaukee, landlords evict roughly 16,000 people. It's about 40 people a day evicted in the city of Milwaukee. If you look only in the inner city, you learn that 1 in 14 renter households is evicted every year. Incredible amount of evictions. Milwaukee's no outlier. The numbers are similar in Kansas City, in Cleveland, in Chicago, in other cities we've looked at. New York City sees 60 Marshall evictions every single day. In 2013, renters in over 2.8 million homes in the United States thought that they would be evicted soon. So these numbers up on the screen, I feel, are really scary. In fact, when the first time I crunched them, I was like, oh, we made this huge mistake. Like, we have to go and do it again. But they only count formal court-ordered evictions. These are evictions that go through the process of the court. But there are other ways, cheaper ways, for landlords to move family out. So Joe Parzynski, he has this way of evicting you where it's like, look, I know you're behind in rent. You're not going to get caught up. If you're out by Sunday, I'll give you like $200 and you can use my van to move. If you got to get evicted, you want like Joe's eviction. I met a landlord that if you're behind, he'll just take your door off. We worked really hard in the survey data to capture all those informal evictions that never see the inside of a court. And if you add those up with formal evictions that do go through the court, if you count landlord foreclosures and if you count building condemnations, like what happened to Arlene's favorite place, you learn that every 2 years, 1 in 8 renters in Milwaukee is displaced involuntarily, 1 in 8. Incredible amount of residential instability. We've long known that poor families move a lot without knowing why. I think one thing that this research shows is that they move so much because they're forced to. Eviction affects the young and the old, the sick and the able-bodied, but the face of America's eviction epidemic is moms with kids. Anyone who's ever been in an urban housing court knows this. It's just a bunch of kids there. In fact, until recently, the housing courts in the South Bronx had a daycare inside of it because there were so many kids coming through the gates. And low-income African-American women in general, and mothers in particular, are evicted at exceedingly high rates. Among Milwaukee renters, 1 in 5 black women report being evicted sometime in their life versus 1 in 15 white women. This is like the feminine equivalent to incarceration. That's what this is. We know that many of our poor young African-American men are being locked up. Many poor African-American women are being locked out. But this isn't just an issue that's located in poor African-American communities. It's also affecting immigrant communities, majority white communities. It's affecting suburban communities as well. 1 in 5 of renters in all the United States report spending at least 50% of their income on housing. It's a widespread problem. So in eviction court, the court commissioner, as is court custom in Milwaukee, gave Arlene 2 extra days for each of her kids. And those days came and went, and she had to be out in a day in early January. So Milwaukee's cold. It's a cold city. And this January was really cold. The weathermen had been working themselves up. They said it would be the coldest day in a decade. They said the temperature could bottom out at 40 below with the wind chill. But if Arlene waited any longer, the landlord would call the sheriff, who days later would arrive with a gun and a folded judge's order and a team of movers, and they would have moved everything on the sidewalk. The meat cuts in the freezer, the mattresses, Jafaris' asthma machine. So they left. The family left. And Jory loaded this U-Haul moving truck that a friend of the family had rented for them. And it was like that kind of cold that's like just like burning cold. You know what I mean? And it was freezing, but he smiled through it. He was happy to be helping his mom. Arlene didn't know where she and the boys would sleep that night. She had tried the lodge and other shelters, but they were full as usual. For now, she was focused on taking what she could to a storage unit that she had sold half of her food stamps and a space heater to rent. So Arlene finally found a room in a shelter about 30 minutes away from Milwaukee, and she once again was on the hunt for another house. So she called on or applied to 20 apartments and then 40, and then 60, and then 80, I counted. She had been accepted to none of them. Even in the inner city, many were out of reach, and the landlords of the places she could afford, if she threw basically everything she had at rent, they weren't calling back either. And then part of the reason, besides her poverty, was her eviction record. So in Milwaukee and many other cities across the United States, your eviction is open. It's free. It's published online. And it's just kind of a website you can go to. And landlords can access it and see the evictions on your name, and they can see how much your previous landlords are claiming you owe. And that is the reason why many families, after they're evicted, are pushed into worse housing and in worse neighborhoods. Many landlords that I spoke to just turn away families that have a recent eviction on the record. And by recent, they usually mean between 2 or 3 years. There's another reason why some landlords weren't calling back. One wanted $8.25 a month plus an additional $25 for jewelry. And Arlene allowed herself to laugh at that. Another flat out told her, "We don't want your kids, ma'am." So children cooped up in small apartments, they use the curtains for superhero capes, and they flush toys down the toilet, and they can cause a man whose car has just been swacked with a snowball to kick your door in. If they're young kids, they can test positive for lead poisoning. That can be expensive. If they're older, they can draw the attention of the police. According to one landlord I spoke to, kids cause us headache. Housing discrimination against families with children is illegal, but it's often not recognized as discrimination. We know from audit studies that families with kids face discrimination in as many out of 7 out of 10 housing searches. It's a lot. Arlene didn't have time to think about that. She just dialed another number. So finally, the 90th landlord, Mr. 90, said yes. He had a one-bedroom apartment. It was $525. Arlene didn't much consider the conditions of the place, or the neighborhood. A house is a house, she told Jory. So 2 months after their eviction court hearing, they moved into their new place. And Arlene liked it. All the cabinets had handles, all the lights had fixtures. And after her and her kids had moved some of the stuff up, Arlene just like sat on the ground, and she found this trash bag with towels in it, and she just leaned against it. And Jory came and sat down. He kind of pitched his head into her shoulder. And Jafaris came and laid his little head on her lap. And they just stayed like that for a long time. So Arlene got her stuff out of storage. She hung pictures on the wall. She liked things neat, so she hung a little note over the sink to Jory that said, "If you don't clean it up after yourself, we're going to have problems." So it's tough to be 14. It's tough to be 14 and experience long stretches of homelessness. Between 7th and 8th grade, Jory went to 5 different schools. And at his new school, he started kind of acting out, and one day a teacher yelled at him, and he kicked her in the shin, and he ran home. And instead of calling the principal, the teacher called the police. And after officers paid Arlene a visit, her landlord told her she had to go. It's kids. Kids. They can prolong the time you're homeless after the eviction, and they often are the reason for your eviction. In fact, when we talked to hundreds of people that were in eviction court, and we asked, why do you get evicted but you don't, even though you both owe the landlord the exact same amount? We found that it wasn't race, it wasn't gender, it wasn't your household income, it wasn't even how much you owe the landlord. It was kids. If you lived with kids, the odds of you receiving an eviction judgment tripled, all else equal. What you're seeing is landlord discretion in that decision. So after that, Arlene kind of started to unravel. "It's like I got a curse on me," she told me. "It won't stop for nothing. Sometimes I find my body trembling, shaking. I'm tired, but I can't sleep. I'm fixing to have a nervous breakdown. My body's trying to shut down." I recently published a study that found that 2 years after their eviction, mothers still experience higher rates of depression. And we know that between 2005 and 2010, suicides attributed to evictions doubled. These were years where housing costs in many of our cities were going up and up and up. "Just my soul is messed up," Arlene told me. "I wish my life were different. I wish that when I be an old lady, I can sit back and look at my kids and they be grown. And they, you know, become something. and we'll all be together and be laughing. We'll be remembering stuff like this and be laughing at it. The home is the center of life. It's the wellspring of personhood. It's our refuge from the menace of the streets, the grind of work or school. We say that at home, we're ourselves. Everywhere else, we're somebody else. At home, we remove our masks. It's where, as children, we imagine, play, question, where, as adolescents, we retreat and try. Get older, we want to settle down in a home, invest in our work, raise a family. In languages spoken all over the world, the word for home encompasses not just shelter, but warmth and family, safety, the womb. Eviction causes loss. Families not only lose their home, their school and neighborhood, but often their possessions, furniture, clothes, books. It takes a good amount of time and money to establish a home. Eviction can erase all that. An eviction can bar you not only from decent housing and safe neighborhoods, but can also prevent you from receiving government aid because housing authorities often turn away families that have evictions on their records, which means we're systematically denying aid to families that most need it. So evicted families are pushed into worse housing and into worse neighborhoods. Eviction can cause workers to lose their jobs. And those of you in this room that have experienced an eviction know why. It's such a consuming, stressful, drawn-out event. It can cause you to make mistakes at work and eventually lose your footing in the labor market. And then there's the toll that eviction has on your spirit, your soul, your mental health. If you add all that up, I think we have to conclude that evictions, which used to be rare in this country, which used to draw crowds in this country, is not just a condition of poverty, it's a cause of it. It's making things worse. And it's leaving a deep and jagged scar on the next generation. We can't fix poverty in this country without fixing housing. So how do we fix it? So imagine if every family in America had access to a decent, affordable place to live. If Arlene didn't have to dedicate 80% of her income on rent, she can keep her kids fed and clothed and off the streets. When families finally receive a housing voucher after years and years on the waiting list, when they finally receive that kind of ticket that allows them not to spend 70, 80% of their income on housing, but 30% of their income on it, they do one consistent thing with their freed up income. They take it to the grocery store. They buy more food. Their kids become stronger, less anemic, better nourished. But the majority of poor families aren't so lucky, and their kids, with names like Jory and Jafaris, aren't getting enough to eat because the rent eats first. I think that if we can't enjoy the freedoms America offers without a roof over our heads, just like the freedom to better ourselves, to invest in our kids, to be part of a community, then shouldn't access to a decent, affordable home be part of what it means to be an American? We've affirmed the provision in old age, basic education, access to decent nutrition as rights in this country because we've agreed that those things are fundamental to human flourishing and economic mobility. And I think it's impossible to argue that housing is not a fundamental human need. I think that housing should be a right of everyone in this country. And the reason is simple. Without stable shelter, everything else falls apart. So how can we deliver on that obligation? The good news is that much has already been accomplished. America has made really impressive strides over the years when it comes to housing. Just a few generations ago, there were slums in our cities. In the middle of Philadelphia, there were outhouses. People were wearing fur coats all year round because there was no heat, no running water in their homes. Children were dying of tuberculosis. We as a country took on a battle with the slum, and we won. We won. And I'll be the first to admit, and the book is very clear-eyed about this, that we still have a long way to go. When I was living in the trailer park, I didn't have hot water for most of the time, and I told the landlord, I'm a writer, I'm going to write about you and your trailer park. So imagine what my neighbors had to go through. But there's no arguing that we've made huge strides in housing quality over the generations. When we take on a big problem, we can fix it. We have. I'm also heartened by the fact that there are hundreds of community organizations around the country employing thousands and thousands of people that are busting hump trying to, like, keep families in their home, preserve affordable housing, and decrease family homelessness. And if you're interested in plugging into these organizations with your time or your money, one thing that we've done with the proceeds of this book is start this kind of meta-organization called Just Shelter, which amplifies this work. So you can go to this website, which is justshelter.org, and you can click on Pennsylvania. And if you live in Philly or Pittsburgh or Norristown or wherever, you can look at the organizations that are working hard on these issues and get plugged in if you want to. A lot of this fight is city by city, block by block. The local is kind of where it's at on this one. But a problem as big as the affordable housing crisis deserves a big solution. And I think that solution, one that would take the dream of a right to housing and make it a reality, would be a universal housing voucher program. So it is really simple. It's not my idea. It's an idea that's been around for a long time. But we would take a program that we already have, the housing voucher program. It's working pretty darn well, but only serving a lucky minority of poor families. And we would expand it to everyone living below the poverty line. And you could take that voucher and you can move anywhere you wanted as long as your housing wasn't too expensive or too shoddy. And instead of paying most of your income to housing, you would pay 30% of your income on it and the voucher would cover the rest. That would fundamentally change the face of poverty in America. It would plunge down family homelessness. Evictions would become rare again. Families would immediately feel the income gains, be able to buy enough food and invest in themselves and their kids through schooling or job training and start a modest savings account. They would find stability and a sense of ownership over their home, their community. Would a program like this be a disincentive to work? It's a fair question. So there is a study that has found that housing assistance leads to a modest reduction in work hours. There's a lot of other studies that have found no relationship, no result. And I think the status quo is much more of a threat to self-sufficiency than any affordable housing program could be. Families crushed by the high cost of housing can't afford to invest in education or job training that will allow them to plug in to the labor market. And many can't stay in the same place long enough to hold down a job. And think of all the talent and energy and brain power that is squandered because families have to spend so much of their focus, their time and their energy trying to make rent or find subsequent shelter after their eviction. A national affordable housing program would be an anti-poverty effort, a human capital investment, a community improvement plan, and a public health initiative all rolled into one. Poverty reduces people born for better things. The poor don't want some small life. They don't want to game the system and eke out an existence. They want to thrive and work and contribute. They want to become nurses or start their own ministries. That was our Lean's goal. And a stable home would allow them a shot at that. Can we afford this thing? So some economists have argued that if we took the current voucher program and we made it more efficient, it could be expanded to a lot more people without additional spending. If we didn't do anything to make the program more efficient, the kind of program that I'm talking about and advocating for would cost us about $22 billion more dollars a year. The figure's probably less. It doesn't account for savings we would accrue that we already spend by like catching all the fallout of eviction in terms of homelessness or increased mental health issues. It's just a number. $22 billion is not a small figure, but it's well within our capacity. We have the money. We've just made choices about how to spend it. So today, housing-related tax expenditures, like the mortgage income tax deduction, they far outpace those for housing assistance to the needy. We already have a universal housing program in this country. It's just not for poor people. So the year Arlene was evicted from 13th Street, federal expenditures for direct housing assistance to the needy totaled about $41 billion. That same year, homeowner tax benefits exceeded $171 billion. That number, $171 billion, that was equivalent to that year's budgets for the Department of Education, Veteran Affairs, Homeland Security, Justice, and Agriculture combined. Rather large figure. Most federal spending on housing benefits families with six-figure incomes. And if we're going to spend the bulk of our public dollars on the affluent, at least when it comes to housing, let's just be honest about that. Let's just own up to that and stop repeating the canard that this wealthy nation can't afford to do more. If poverty persists in America, it's not for lack of resources. We lack something else. So there's one policy suggestion. Let others come. A establishing the basic right to housing in America could be realized in any number of ways and probably should be. What works in Philadelphia would fail in Milwaukee. What New York needs, Houston doesn't. One city has to build, another has to destroy. Our cities are different. They're rich in problems and gifts, and maybe our public policy should be too. But I think whatever our way out of this mess, one thing is certain. This degree of inequality, this level of social suffering, this blunting of human capacity, this cold denial of basic needs, this isn't us. This doesn't have to be us. By no American value is this situation justified. There is no moral code or ethical principle or piece of scripture or holy teaching that can be summoned to defend what we've allowed our country to become. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is David Wengert. I'm with Community Legal Services here in Philadelphia. I have kind of two parts of a question. One, I wanted you to talk a little bit about your ideas around legal services for people who are being evicted, as well as what are your thoughts regarding the actual cost of maintaining housing and how hard it is actually on the landlord side to afford the cost of maintaining housing that oftentimes was built 100 years ago and that sort of thing.
So unlike in criminal court, if you're arrested for a crime, you have a right to an attorney. You have no such right in civil court. And so most families that get evicted have absolutely no legal representation. In many housing courts around the country, 90% of tenants have no lawyer and 90% of landlords do. And so many tenants don't show up. Like 70% of folks summoned to housing court in Milwaukee just don't come. I probably wouldn't come if I had to face off with a lawyer, and I have a PhD. Arlene's got an 11th grade education. And so one way that we could stop evictions or curb eviction would be to provide public legal assistance to families in eviction court facing eviction. This would curb frivolous evictions. This would allow folks that have their case made, unlike the majority of cases today. And I think it would be smart investment in public funds upstream that would stem the tide of costs downstream that we pay for evictions. I think the work you do is really important. I wish there were like hundreds of thousands more of you. It's true that we need to have landlords at the table in these conversations. You know, and the book really tries to complicate that relationship. I think we let ourselves off the hook if we say, look at these tenants, they're so irresponsible. Or look at these landlords, they're so greedy. I think when you look at the problem on the ground level, you realize it is a lot more complicated than that. Landlords do incur a lot of costs. One thing that I did wonder when I started this project is, why would you own and operate property in some of the poorest neighborhoods? When I finished the project, I was like, why wouldn't you do it? You can make a decent profit, sometimes quite a substantial profit, not in spite of those neighborhoods' poverties, but often because of it. What makes owning a home in poor neighborhoods a risky investment, low property values, and low taxes, makes renting it a potentially lucrative one. But you're right that landlords often do have to kind of face the challenge of keeping old and decaying housing stock up to code. If most of our poor families live in the public market, public rental market, in this exact kind of housing, we need to bring landlords to the table and kind of work with them if we're going to have a solution that's to scale.
I wanted to ask you about, I guess, research ethics.
Yeah.
Given that your cultural position as a white male based in an Ivy League institution, working with, when you work with people, you know, who are often rendered voiceless and invisible in because of their gender, race, and class. Like, how do you think this dynamic shaped your research and your relationship with your research subjects?
Yeah, so I wasn't at Harvard when I did this work. I feel like I'm there now, but that's the first private institution I've ever been a part of. I think that it's important. It matters. It matters every day. And it's not just the normal things that we talk about, like your race and gender and class upbringing. It's also like how your teeth look, your accent, how you talk, carry yourself, your disposition. All that stuff matters for what people, how people open up to you or close up to you. One thing that I'm doing to try to capture eviction stories and allow folks that have experienced these things to kind of own their own story is in Just Shelter, there's an avenue where people can upload their eviction story and share with the world if they want to. And we've got a lot of stories already when we're publishing on them, and that's something that we're really excited about. Everyone in this book read this book a long time before you guys did, and I walked through it with them. And one of the interesting things that happened is that a book like this allows folks to tell their story a little differently. And so when I was in college, my family got foreclosed. We lost my childhood home. And I remember going back and helping my family move, and I remember experiencing that moment. Like, I remember feeling embarrassed. I remember feeling ashamed. I didn't kind of have any kind of broader story or broader narrative for why that happened. And a lot of folks in this book, like Arlene, experienced their eviction like that too. And I think what this project has a shot at doing is to allow Arlene to see herself as part of a larger narrative, a larger story. And that's been like an unanticipated and really cool thing that's come out of it. So when we talk about this, she often says, you know, I see like strength in my story now, which has been really great. My what we call positionality in sociology terms, you know, it opened some doors and closed some doors. And so here's just one story about something that I learned because I was a white guy. So I was hanging out with two women, African-American women, Crystal and Vanetta, and they were looking for housing on the south side of Milwaukee. That's predominantly Latino neighborhoods. And I was in the car for this time and watching Vanetta's kids, and they both went in, they came back out after an exchange with the landlord. And what they said was, you know, they were looking around, and they said, you know, do you have a place with a tub? You know, if you have young kids, you know, like, you need a tub, a bath, you know? And so the landlord's like, yeah, I have a bigger place, slightly nicer, the same rent, so like, sounded really good. And then he kind of like stopped himself and pretended to answer his phone and was like, you know, golly gee, it just rented out, wouldn't you know it? And so they came out, and they were so fresh, they felt so dissed, you know, and so angry. And so just think of it, like, you're homeless, you're trying to get housing for your kids, and you face that. So I wrote down the landlord's number, and I called them the next day, and I'm not a black woman, and I went and I applied for that housing, and I told them I had the exact same income that they did, the number of kids that they did. And then I said, you know what, do you have a place with a tub? And he drove me to the place with the tub, and he showed me the tub place, and then I turned him into the Fair Housing Council. So I think that there's certain parts of your positionality that open up and allow you to in some claims, and there's other parts that close it. Yeah.
Yeah, hi. I know that at least one organization in Philadelphia, and probably more than one, are thinking about starting a tenants union sort of organization. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the role that an organization structured like that would play in your kind of vision for universal housing.
So most cities in the United States no longer have tenants unions. I think like 8 cities do. It's really rare these days. But what you do see in cities that have tenants organizations is you see community mobilization around things like just cause evictions. Just cause. In most cities, you can evict someone without cause. They're called like a 30-day eviction notice or no-cause eviction. Tenants unions are advocating for that. They're doing things like eviction blockades, which we used to do back in the day and kind of have become rare again as evictions become normalized. So I think a tenants union is just kind of a way of saying there's people that are renters that may be thinking of themselves as a class with shared interests and political voice. And that seems to be a really healthy part of democracy.
I'm a formerly homeless mother of 4 who is a housing activist.
Yeah.
I also am now a developer and a housing provider to low-income families.
Yeah.
Although I'm doing this, I still live in subsidized housing. I'm not making that much money. One of the things that I find, I like to ask you personally, how do you think that we can put affordable housing on the ballot for people who are running for president?
Yeah.
To make this really an important issue across the country. And also, there are people who are ex-offenders or returning citizens who have felonies who can't get housing. And I find that a lot of African-American males are dealing with going back into the prisons because they can't find a place to live. And if you have Section 8 or public housing, they can't come live with you either. So I think that when we're dealing with the housing nationally, we also need to make people who are returning citizens from the penal system able to get some type of subsidized housing as well.
You can clap for that if you want. First of all, your story, even just shared in that really nugget, is really inspiring, and I just like applaud you for sharing it. And I hope you write your book one day. The problem is real, but I'm encouraged that we in the country are starting to have a national conversation about inequality today. It's a conversation that's happening on both sides of the aisle. So earlier today, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was testifying in front of Congress. And, you know, one congressperson said, you know, what really makes us respond is external pressure. And so I think that the fact that we're having this conversation, that folks are working toward these things, that we're kind of asking it again to be pushed and to be raised up on the kind of domestic agenda is something that a lot of folks that are working in Washington care a lot about. And I know it's hard to, there's people running right now, but there's also people working. And I think that, you know, with the people working right now on these issues, I think there is a lot of traction. And I have a lot of optimism. You're absolutely right to kind of raise the point about how the mark of a criminal record can really be a bind on the housing market for you. So I was encouraged that a few weeks ago, the Secretary of HUD, Julian Castro, made a very public pronouncement that folks with felonies will be protected now under the Fair Housing Act, that it's not okay to discriminate against folks with that. And if we want to give folks that have done their time a shot at community reintegration, gosh, that's so important. You're right. So that's a good move in our, yeah.
I'm with TURN, which is an organization like you just described that tries to organize tenants and do active things. We're working on the just cause evictions, so I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm also curious if there are other issues that you think are critical in terms of the landlord-tenant process, And I'd also like you to comment on gentrification, whether if you had a chance to look at that and whether it has a relationship to the kind of crisis you're talking about.
There's so much that we need to care about in terms of housing and the landlord-tenant process. One of them is housing problems and housing conditions. We know this is really bad for kids and adults' health. It's hard to do homework when you're living in substandard conditions. And I think that housing quality and housing unaffordability go hand in hand. And what I saw in Milwaukee was, you know, if you're someone like Arlene that moves in with 80% of your income going to rent, you can't afford first month's rent, last month's rent, security deposit. So a lot of tenants move in behind from day one. And so what landlords do, like what Sharina, Arlene's landlord, did, is she basically said, you give me a break, I'll give you a break. And what that meant was that Sharina provided you housing, and in exchange, she kind of got to, like, slack off a bit on maintaining the housing. You could call the building inspector and report, but you greatly increased your risk of eviction if you did that. It's illegal to retaliate against tenants that make that call, but you can evict someone at any time if they're behind. And so unless we kind of address that fundamental issue, that housing unaffordability issue, the laws on the books that we have aren't gonna gain full potency. From a landlord's perspective, there's a lot of housing code that maybe is superfluous. And so what can we offer landlords? How can we kind of bring them to the table? I think one thing is a lot of landlords that I met that you can turn away folks with housing vouchers. You don't have to take them in most cities. And the reason they did that was for inspectors. They didn't want an extra inspection. Some things about the housing code are fundamental to human flourishing and dignity and kids' health, and some things aren't. And maybe we should put those things on the table. Gentrification. So I think there's two ways to think about gentrification. There's the gentrification, which is like, I don't even know Philly that well, so what would be like the gentrified neighborhood? You know, like, so, have you been to so-and-so? It's gentrifying. There it is, yeah. There's a juice bar there now. People are doing yoga there now. And so that kind of gentrification, every city I've looked at, most evictions don't take place in those neighborhoods. They're taking place, North Philly, West Philly, they're taking place in very poor neighborhoods. If we care about displacement, the places we need to look at is our poorest, ungentrifying neighborhoods. There's this other kind of gentrification, though, that I think we're seeing in kind of an exaggerated form these days, which is like whole cities are becoming gentrified. And whole cities are becoming really unaffordable, even to kind of middle-class families. And there's political constraints that make that a really tough problem. So take Boston. Boston has one revenue source, it's property tax. Half of the city is exempt, right, because it's a hospital or a university. To raise the rate of property tax, you have to get state legislative approval. So you're the mayor of Boston. You need to, like, fund your schools and stuff. What do? You gentrify your city. And so I think that that's a level of gentrification that I think should be concern a lot of us. Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm Helen Gim. I'm a new councilwoman to Philadelphia, actually.
All right.
So I'm, you know, obviously inspired by your work and really grateful for it, but thinking really seriously about how municipal policy can take a look at things. I know we've had discussions about just cause eviction. We've taken a look at investments in our legal services to address the court issue. But are there, and I know that each city is going to be particularly unique, but are there areas that you see local municipalities moving on policy as we wait for federal housing vouchers to kind of come through that are particularly inspiring? That would be question number one. And question number two is we're putting a huge amount of effort into building new, quote-unquote, affordable housing in Philadelphia. And we do have this existing housing stock that is old, decaying in serious amounts of disrepair, but it's where the majority of our folks are going to actually find, quote-unquote, affordable housing. And so that tension that we've got with developers that are moving into the affordable market, supposedly, but the contrast with this vast stock of housing that we have already in our neighborhoods and communities is a real question about investment and political priorities.
I think preserving that housing stock is really, really important. And over the generations, most poor families have lived in hand-me-down housing, so to speak. You know, it's really hard to build for low-income families. And so I think that preserving that housing stock is the most efficient thing that we could do when it comes to addressing the problem of, like, the affordable housing stock in our cities. And that means not allowing places to go into disrepair, to keeping up on the building code, to make sure tax foreclosures are used in the right way and not a wrong way, making sure that folks that own property don't run them into the ground. I think those are really, really important. Another thing that cities can do that have a big impact is to establish kind of a short-term emergency fund for families that have experienced a temporary loss of income. So when Milwaukee, for example, got stimulus funds in 2009, they used a bunch of those funds to just have this, like, just it's kind of like a gap or a Band-Aid measure. So if you lose your job, experience a medical setback, some significant but public benefit sanction, some big but temporary loss of income, that fund could be activated to come and bridge the gap to prevent you from eviction. When the city started doing that, it decreased evictions by 15%. That's something. And so I think that there are things that cities can do that are really really effective and really inspiring. And it kind of depends on how your city is made up. You know, there's amazing things going on with housing land trusts in Houston right now. There's really cool things going on in Baltimore about vacancy housing. One thing that we can consider, too, is zoning laws, regulation. This is a tricky topic, but there's really good evidence that exclusive zoning laws drive up the cost of construction, and they also prevent low-income families from moving into safe neighborhoods, good neighborhoods. I think we should kind of put those on the table, too, and ask what work these regulations are doing for communities, and especially how they're impacting low-income families. Okay, thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.